You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Man there trying to stop Drogba getting himself into further trouble.
It's a fucking disgrace.
Oh, it's not a bad ball for Pelé on the right side. It's Carlos Alberto. And what a great goal that was! Carlos Alberto!
Maradona just walked away from Huddle then. Maradona, Smoking.
Met het balbezit voor Frank de Boer. Frank de Boer speelt de bal. Heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan. Dennis Bergkamp.
Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp.
Oh! Frank de Boer speelt de bal naar Dennis Bergkamp. Die neemt de bal feilloos aan. En die schiet de bal erin.
Hello and welcome to the Scoreless Syrup podcast. I'm Alex and I'm joined as always by Leon. Leon, how are you doing?
Doing great and very happy to be here tonight.
And we're delighted to be joined today by Marcela Mora y Araujo. Marcela is a Argentinian football journalist and she wrote the obituary for Diego Maradona in The Guardian, and she wrote the chapter in the book The Jaws of Victory, A History of Football's Nearly Men, which we are going to cover on the podcast today, talking about the Argentinian national team between 2006 and 2014, which is kind of the story, I feel, of Messi's pursuit of a tournament victory for the national team. But before we sort of go into that story and also the Messi thing, I'm kind of curious to get your perspective on how has Argentina sort of dealt with the death of Maradona in the past couple of months? In particular, how has it sort of dealt with moving forward with his legacy and how it kind of places him both in that culturally and also within football?
So I think there's lots of there's many different angles at which we can look at what the impact of Maradona's death has been in Argentina. One is the media coverage. I think throughout his life he was very prominent as a content facilitator, if you like, as a provider of content, and that hasn't ceased since his death. There is an ongoing investigation into the circumstances surrounding his death. Was there any negligence on the part of the medical team that was in charge of his post-op recovery? And every day new phones are hacked or new developments arise, or the prosecutors call new witnesses, and that is incredibly prominent here locally, that the TV and the more sensationalist papers cover it all the time. And it's quite a dark and sinister tale, really. There aren't very many happy takeaways from what's going on there. It really seems that he was not very well looked after, and really very unwell in the last, certainly the last week of his life, and maybe the last couple of weeks. So that dominates the media narrative quite a lot. And then there's the kind of the more emotional, raw response from people, from either football lovers or just people generally. You know, I've been working on a football documentary now about the 1986 World Cup. So I've had lots of occasion to talk about that time, and people are genuinely concerned and keen to discuss their own memories of him as if it was someone they truly knew. It's really interesting. It's like loads of different people from all walks of life, older women, young children who've maybe never seen him play, but everybody has a very personal response to the fact that he died, how brilliant a player he was, what his life had been like. And I find that very interesting, because it's not like a distant celebrity. It's like someone close to them has died. And I think that it is quite telling of how he worked emotionally as a celebrity, that it somehow he made everyone feel they were close to him, or that he was an important part of our lives, even though we maybe didn't, you know him at all. But overall, I think that the balance between those things, the true emotional response to loss that's very genuine from people, and the overwhelming story of just a sordid and tragic life of excess that ended very sadly and lonely and in quite a dark way, that's just being played out all the time. So a little bit like when he was alive, there's this kind of, there's two things that are constantly being weighed up against each other, a kind of deity, almost deity-like adoration for an idol, combined with this just grueling and gruesome horror of, you know, addiction and despair and betrayal and loneliness. That's how I see it anyway.
And has there been sort of a move towards like a reckoning, sort of how people have sort of facilitated his successes in the way that, you know, people looking, like reflecting back onto society, is there things that we should, like, people should have done, stop the kind of train before it got along that way? And, you know, like, in, I'm thinking of things like his doctor becoming like a media personality and stuff like this.
Well, the doctor that was on the media every day outside the hospital is one of the people that's been indicted and is under investigation. So he gave a press conference in which he burst into tears and said, I did everything I could, and so on. No, I don't think there's any societal reckoning at all. I mean, I personally think there should be, and I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned about how, overall, as societies, and I don't mean just in Argentina, we treat celebrity and particularly, the pathology in celebrity, and we just consume it like as entertainment. In a way, Maradona is like the ultimate Truman, the reality show par excellence of our time. But I don't see that there's any of that going on, certainly not in the media, but also, I mean, I tweeted not so long after he died, we should all we were all responsible, we could all have helped prevent this, and I got quite a lot of people saying, not me, mate, there's nothing I could have done. I mean, that, no, I don't think, you know, I don't think people feel responsible at all as a society. I think, I mean, I've been interviewing a lot of his teammates from 1986, and I get the sense that they loved him very much, but it was difficult to get to him. I feel he was quite isolated from his true friends in the last few months, for sure, and maybe even some of his children. I think he was surrounded by, he always had an entourage, which changed over time, but there's always a kind of an inner circle. And I think this last one was quite fears in the guarding of him. So very few people had access to him, even those who loved him. And I think that's possibly quite tragic and something that has been aired quite a lot. But even those close to him knew that there wasn't much else they could do because it was very difficult to get to him. And I think, you know, he chose his life and the way to live it and the people around him. And it was very difficult to get around that. So I don't see what anyone could have done particularly. I think this the lawyer who was working with him most closely and who appointed the doctor who is now indicted, there's a whole series of things they've done, like they've patented every name under the sun that might be vaguely similar to Diego or Maradona or the Hand of God. And then there was a list published the other day about this kind of 100 and something names that they've kind of patented as belonging to them. And there's also some strange documents whereby he seems to have signed rights for certain things to these people, which again is being questioned in court. So it's all very much not your run-of-the-mill situation. You know, there isn't a straightforward estate to be divvied up between straightforward inheritors, that nothing straightforward. And I think the society at large thinks, well, he wasn't like any of us, really. He was different. Different rules applied to him, different expectations. So there isn't a sort of, oh, we should have done it differently. It's very much like something you watch. That happened next, and then that happened next.
And it's something to be a product to be enjoyed, right? Yeah. It's like he's not one of us. It's like an art that we enjoy.
I think it's very interesting, though, because in the one documentary we watched for preparation, they talked a lot about Diego as this one persona and then Maradona as the public persona. And while Maradona was dealing with everything and also building maybe a facade that then is seen by the broader public, there was still Diego, the small boy from Via Fiorito, I think, if I pronounced it correctly, who was very much a person and a young boy trying to figure out how everything works and very relatable also. Towards his friends and his closer relatives. But then as his career moved on, the Maradona persona became more and more dominant. At least that's kind of what I took out from that.
I think that's Fernando Signorini, who was his physical trainer and coach for many, many years, said that in Capadia's film. And he's in fact said it a lot of times. With Diego, I would go to the end of the world, but with Maradona, I wouldn't walk to the corner of the street. And it kind of stuck. And I mean, I like that distinction in Capadia's film, but I don't believe that there are two separate beings. I think Diego Maradona is one person. And I think both or all sides of him are part of one single thing. And this is something I've kind of held for a very long time. I think this idea that he's clever with his feet but stupid with his head, or an artist with the ball but an idiot in, you know, as a father, I just don't believe you can do that distinction that simply. And I don't think it's conducive to anything interesting. I mean, I love Fernando Signorini very much and I have a lot of time for him, but I would disagree that and I don't think he meant it as a real distinction. I think he was just saying, it was a way of saying there is a side of Diego that I'm familiar with and that I love very much and that I'm comfortable with. But when he becomes the celebrity, I don't want to be around him. And I think it's precisely because he was always the celebrity at some level, or always the you know, he's meshed into one. I mean, sometimes I think of it as a Möbius strip. You know, you think, oh, that side A is Diego and side B is Maradona, and we can just turn it around. But in fact, it's like a single, continuous, two-sided piece of eternal tape. And even the two goals against England, I now refused to acknowledge them as two separate goals. I'm just thinking it was one incident that starts before the handball and ends at the end of this of the solo run, and it's just a few minutes where a single event happened, after which the result says two, whatever, it doesn't even matter. But he is always constantly the same thing, and it's inescapable. And so you know, the daughters are the daughters of Maradona, and the you know, the nurse is having to either, you know, get some pills down Maradona. And, you know, there isn't a Diego, I think. I mean, I know some people who are quite well known and they manage to keep a distinction. They, you know, they put a persona on and go on stage and perform, and then they're very different. And they've got a private life that they are handling well. And in those cases, I would say, oh, there is the celebrity, and then there's my friend, and they're two distinct kind of modes, if you like. Yeah. You switch. But I don't think he could do that. I think more than anyone I know, he was inescapably Diego Maradona all the time.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you I thought of when you were just speaking there was you mentioned you were speaking to his teammates from the 1986 World Cup, and I've in the days after his death, I remember reading a lot of people talking about why he was sort of so loved by his teammates, was that, you know, he wouldn't throw his hands up in the air and look very frustrated. And they compared this to sort of other superstar players who would get frustrated with their teammates and not being at the same level. Is this sense sort of something that you've heard from them as well, that even though he was at another level, he was still able to sort of mesh and compartmentalize the talents of his teammates?
Yes. I think particularly in the 1986 World Cup, but practically everybody who's ever worked with him in football says that. You know, he was a hard worker, and he was very much not someone to put his hands up and say, oh, that was your fault. I mean, these guys revere him, and they constantly say he was one of us, but then they relay a kind of daily life that shows he was absolutely not one of them. Completely his own rules and own thing going on. But he was definitely a good member of the team. He was a teammate, and he was very loyal to them and to other players. You know, I mean, I don't want to say he wasn't a prima donna, because in a way he was the prima donna par excellence, but he loved football, and that's real and that's genuine. And I think he made a real effort to train and play and run for the ball and partake with his teammates. I mean, it's quite lovely narrative working out in terms of how, although Bilardo had said before the World Cup, this will be Maradona plus 10, and that's the only certainty about this group, that they all worked in a system where, you know, they could get the best of Maradona, but then each had a really important function to fulfill and a role. But he was participative in allowing to happen, you know, I think. But I don't think he would have become such an adored and revered player if he hadn't been able to work in a team, because football is a team game. We were talking about Cortázar a little earlier, who really didn't like football because he didn't feel it had the drama of solo sports. He thought tennis and boxing, where it's kind of one man duels with another, or woman, and if we bringing it to up to date times. But teams, whereas football really needs a team. You can't have, you know, you can have a great player alone, but ultimately that's just not what moves us about the game. The game works as an emotional inspiration if you have a good team doing something collectively. Even if they're not very good, but you still need to know where they are in relation to each other, what the spaces are, what's happening on the whole pitch. Maradona was the best at that as well as the best with the ball. So he could dribble and head and do all his little kicky tricks and whatever, but he was an incredibly intelligent reader of the entire pitch, and he knew what was going on, and he was able to aid everyone for the best result possible. And you can see it match by match in 1986, how they all start to learn better how to function. So for sure, I think that was absolutely his, you know, the thing that made him amazing while he was a player. But he hasn't been playing football for a very long time, and he still remained amazing. So, you know, we need to kind of keep looking at what was going on with this guy, because 1986 was a very long time ago.
I'm thinking, because you talked about Gaudata, and that he said that some other sports may bring along more drama, but isn't the kasi-kasi element that you described in the chapter, which is about always just falling short of something in football, isn't that this bittersweet element that also we have talked a lot about in this podcast, isn't that also something that conveys a lot of drama and human emotions, and that is maybe in that regard not particular to football but especially strong in that game, because there's so many factors, because there's so many different variables that you have to think about and that can come together?
Definitely. I mean, I don't agree with Cortázar.
Argue against him.
you're reading him. I think football is the perfect conduit for all of those things, which can happen in any or many other spheres. I mean, of arts, of drama, of performing arts. I mean, just now I've been working with a friend who writes music and helping her write a thing about how she writes music. And I was thinking, you could say this about football as well. You know, there's many facets of creative endeavors and performance. So football is performative and it's creative. And then also, because it's competitive, it has the elements of conflict or war, like, you know, there's some people like metaphors with war or military action. Definitely competition at the highest level. And so it has many ingredients that we could all relate to, and from you can come at it from different angles. So it's, I think you can explain its appeal very well if you are willing to accept the incredible variety of, you could say it's like dance with a dancer trying to stop you from dancing at the same time or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember saying that to a dancer many years ago, where we were talking about whether football was like dance. And then he said, oh yeah, I forgot about the other team. It was like, you know, I was like, now imagine someone's doing it at the same time trying to stop you. And it was like, So that is brilliant. You know, and we could talk for hours about why football is so appealing and marvelous. I think it's the competitive side, the results, the point scoring, but some Argentinians have called it the resultist dictatorship, you know, the pure lovers of the beautiful game. Others, like Bilardo, Bilardo said, look, you don't come second, you know, either you win or you failed. And and he drove that through every day for 3 years before. And I personally, I don't like that particularly. I think, you know, I mean, your podcast is called The Scoreless Thriller. I think 0-0 should be a valid result. Yeah. I think the draw is the best thing. Why not? Just give the cup to everybody, for God's sake. Thank you for playing. But because the edge of winning is so, you know, the adrenaline is undeniable, then you get another level of engagement, emotional engagement. So people, you know, even people like me who claim not to care about the results get palpitations at a penalty shootout, or, you know, suddenly it matters. Why does this matter? Nobody knows. And I think that's what I was trying to kind of convey in the chapter, the kasi-kasi, which is, you know, almost or nearly, which you say a lot with a ball that touches a post or it just goes out, or all the time in football, you're, oh my God, that was almost, almost. But actually, ultimately, what do we mean almost? I mean, especially with regard to Messi, which is what I was ultimately writing about. But I think I do mention Maradona. There is no almost. There's no casi casi. These guys have, you know, they've achieved what none of us could have dreamed of ever, several times over. So it's completely absurd in a way to say, oh, they almost won this, or he almost scored, or he all, when he's done everything he's done, which is perform his art consistently, outstandingly for decades, to the delight of millions and millions of people around the world, possibly generations to come, generations before. What, almost what? He almost what? He did it. He did it.
There is no almost, right? It's, I mean,
there's no almost.
Yeah.
I think there is this element that this insatiable demand for yet another talent, for yet another trophy, for yet another win. I mean, you couldn't see it quite clearly with Napoli, right? After they won the league and they won the cup. And then Maradona says, I've had enough. I'd like to move on, find something new, a new challenge maybe also. But they are so insisting on keeping him as kind of the guarantor for winning. There is this insatiable demand by the fans, by the clubs, by everyone to keep it going. So it is kind of this perpetuation of the casi, right? Even though you have the trophy, even though you have won something, it's still the next season starts and it starts all over again. And it's like this perpetual motion in some regards, is it not?
Yes, I think so. And I think if you lose that, then something's over. You know, if fans were to go, well, we're very happy, we're very satisfied with our lot, and we're proud, and that's fine for us, you know, yeah, ready to die now. Or TV said, no, we've shown enough. It's good.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want a scandal. We're not going to discuss whether it was in or out, or the VAR made a mistake. A kind of contentment is anathema to keeping the industry going, keeping the wheels in motion, and keeping the desire going, I think. I mean, I think ultimately it does have to do with desire, satisfaction, contentment, and, you know, thirst or hunger for a new desire. So in the same way that perhaps the player himself, be it Maradona at Naples or Messi now at Barcelona, or anyone, you know, they might go, well, this is it for me here. I want a new challenge, a new surroundings, change of scene. And that's not really very acceptable to anybody. It's not kind of, it's very difficult to kind of allow that in a way. So it is a perpetual motion system. And if it stops, which I kind of felt earlier in 2020, there was a moment when there was no football. And I thought, oh my God, this is really serious. There's actually no football being played anywhere on the planet. That's never happened in my lifetime. And, you know, it felt more grave than anything else, that this was kind of, if it finally happened. And in fact, I even wrote a little thing which said, well, maybe Maradona will die now, because if there is no football, what does Maradona do? And then he did die later that year, and I thought, oh my God, I killed him. But I don't think it was me. It was just suddenly there was imaginable. A whole load of unimaginable things became imaginable. So you could say, what set of circumstances would need to happen for Maradona to die? Or what set of circumstances would need to happen for there to be no football? And suddenly we had this world where the most unexpected set of circumstances were made. They made everything stop, not, you know, but for me, it was the fact that there was no football being played that really brought it home. And I suspect for artists, it was the fact that there's no theatres or cinemas or live music. But I don't know. I think we couldn't. It would be very strange if a lot of people thought like me and thought, yes, it's a lovely game. We just want to see everyone enjoying themselves and the score doesn't matter. It would just be a different thing completely.
You win some, however, you lose some.
Yeah, I think it's good to keep that voice alive and alert, you know, to say, okay, but we need to be careful here what we're expecting, whether it's of Maradona trying to leave a club or Maradona trying to live a normal life or Messi trying to find a new contract or do, you know, we consume celebritydom and we demand of our athletes more than we would of someone we knew personally or of a human being we cared about. And I think that dehumanization of the players is quite dangerous. And I think we do it a lot. And I've now kind of been close to football for long enough that I can see it's not something that changes. Some people say, oh, it's different now. You know, it's different now. In 1986, the press was different or new media is different. But nothing's really changing in terms of our expectations of what they do. And again, to have a kind of quote pandemic times at the beginning of the lockdowns about a year ago in the UK, where I usually live, there was a lot of debate about whether players should take a pay cut because most people were, and they, you know, in solidarity with society, they should be paid less or they should be forced to give part of their wages to, you know, the NHS or something. And again, I felt very angry about that because I think most footballers are from very humble backgrounds and they, you know, they know adversity and financial insecurity better than most. And a lot of them do choose to give a lot back to their community, families, friends, sport, whatever. A lot of them do. And then Marcus Rashford, this English player, started this campaign against child food poverty, which is a huge issue in England in 2020. You know, yeah. Children go hungry and unimaginably. It took a football player to say, I went through that, and this is important, to kind of create awareness. So it's not like the player just gave his own wages. He did proper, you know, active, transformative social action, which is really important. And I see it in South America all the time with footballers. They do become very involved. They might build a hospital or a school or even a town or put electric lighting in a neighborhood where they grew up, where there's no running water or electricity. They do this a lot. And I think as societies, we can keep focusing and rescuing that side of the sport, the one that can, you know, that can reach people and implement change and create awareness of issues without always just kind of going, oh no, the player should earn less or the player should earn more or the player should score more or we should sell him, he's always on the bench. So I think that kind of very limited grid by which we judge the game, it's okay for the duration of the game, which is ultimately quite short. And then, you know, if, well, I don't think we have to, but we could, just be a little bit more flexible about our powers to judge and consume certain aspects of the industry and advocate and encourage others. So I would say buy less branded trainers and give more to, you know, courses that footballers endorse that we agree with. I mean, some footballers are also notoriously, you know, ideologically not aligned with my views. I mean, in South America, a lot have become politicians in the extreme right and all sorts of things. Okay. But that, you know, they're people like everyone. So I think if we encourage them to be thinking sentient beings, I mean, some examples are really interesting, like Faustino Asprilla in Colombia, who is, you know, but permanently kind of advocating for anti-wokeness and
in your Twitter bio that you're an anti-VAR mingler, and I was just curious as to what you think something like VAR does to this sort of, because for me, I think it's like the way it distorts something, which is like the most purest thing in football, which is the few seconds after there is a goal. And now you have this sort of like weird cultural thing where, you know, people, players are less wanting to celebrate goals because they'll look stupid and end up on a meme like Pep Guardiola, or there's also like very new thing of people before we had the lockdowns, crowds celebrating the kind of a VAR decision, right? You know, which is very, it was like, you know, no one had ever celebrated a VAR decision or something like that before. And what do you think this kind of will do to the way we sort of consume football, and also how like football sort of is plays out for people?
Well, I don't like VAR because I to me it slows the game. It doesn't slow it. It doesn't slow the game. It breaks it up in a very American way. And I think, it just breaks the flow of it. You know, I think mistakes are part of it, and really bad ones, such as the hand of God. VAR, somebody said when Maradona died, VAR would have not, you know, would have not allowed either of those two goals. Yeah. And that's...
yeah.
Then the whole history of humanity would be different. So I don't like VAR because of that, but it annoys me. I think it's part of the Americanization of soccer. I think it's, you know, in the mid 90s when the US started to toy with the idea of soccer being part of their world, and they had held the World Cup and so on, and the things we were looking at that would make it appealing for the American audience was more goals, less dribbly, more action. And VAR kind of does that. You know, there's a lot more, I don't know, set pieces and to
penalties,
me,
ridiculous handballs.
But then I guess, you know, technology is part of the world, and we all have to adapt. And I think, you know, I'm closer to 100 than zero in age. And I suspect that it's people closer to zero that will live in a world that is far more comfortable with technology than certainly I am and my generation. So in tennis, I remember the debate about the eye that would say if the ball was in or out, and we were all going, oh, but then John McEnroe, what will he do? And it was like, well, maybe he'll be a rock star or a TV commentator, you know. We'll all find something to do.
The technical stuff never even works. Like oftentimes I feel they interrupt the game, then they make a decision, and afterwards everyone still is annoyed,
more angry than they were even before.
There's no decision. It's still
I've yet to see a VAR moment that makes me think, oh, thank God that VAR was there, you know.
Exactly.
That's made it better. But who knows? I mean, I don't see what the arguments are for it at all. But if it's here to stay, then I guess it's, beauty will happen around it anyway, ultimately. And maybe people will go, well, it was, you know, VAR annulled it, but it was the best dribble past seven players anyone's ever seen in the history. So you know, we will all like respect the altar of the gifted, whether or not it's allowed.
Yeah. No, so to bring it back to the book chapter, I mean, before I'd read it, I'd never quite realized quite how close apparently that Messi came to playing for Spain. So you have the situation with the hastily arranged under 20s friendly against Paraguay, so basically just to tie him down to the national team. How has he ever, like, in the years since, sort of spoken about this, or how is this incident kind of viewed in Argentina, and is this sort of like viewed as kind of a maybe black mark against his, like, quote unquote Argentinianness, that this was sort of a somewhat possibility?
No, I don't think it would be a black mark against him at all, because I don't think
in how he's viewed.
First, I don't think it's a very particularly well-known episode. I mean, I myself only heard about it fairly recently, but I think it's interesting in that that's what you expect is that, you know, that when a great talent appears, but people will go to great lengths to claim and hog that great talent. Other than that, I don't think there's nothing really underhand about it, or I don't think he was going to play for Spain. I mean, his father and himself were closely involved in setting this up, so I think they wanted to make sure that he would be, certainly his father, that he would be an Argentinian player. The rules about nationality change quite, you know, periodically, so we have kind of famous cases of players in Argentina who maybe played for another country in their youth without realizing, and then they were ineligible to play for the national team. But ultimately that shifts. I think the whole concept of nationality will shift over time anyway. And there might be some leeway. Players can change nationality the same way that people can, you know. But I like the anecdote because I didn't realize, again, you know, on this concept of almost or Cassi, you think, well, he almost wasn't even Argentinian. So it was really to play with that idea. But I don't think he himself was so keen on playing for Spain that Argentina, you know, holds that against him at all. And I suspect if he had signed up for Spain, we might not even have known. You know, you might go, oh, that player was born in Rosario, a bit like Trezeguet, who played for France, you know, is kind of an Argentinian personality that we all quite like, even though he played for France. It's not, you don't, you know, again, I kind of call on other arts and fields, and there's all sorts of people who are recognized as Argentinian who've invented the Bic Biro or won Nobel Prizes for chemistry, or, you know, great composers of Hollywood, or, you know, there's enormous range of Argentinians who we take great pride in saying, oh, they're from Argentina like we are, but in fact worked and operated under another nationality, whether through passport or through living abroad or whatever. So Messi could have been that. He could have been a Spanish player for Spain that we all said, oh, he's from Rosario, you know, and we'd claim him as our own as well, I think.
Which is kind of a nice egg, right? Because the challenges is exactly what you meant earlier, the nationality, right? Because oftentimes it is not just that, but people come from different places, move somewhere else and interact with people from all over the places. So
yeah,
it's more fluid, I guess. But then do Argentinians hold against Messi that he never actually won a title with the team then?
I think some, yeah. I mean, again, I think there's a media-fed narrative that is, oh, he still owes us something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think if you stop people randomly in the street, they would be more proud and delighted by his existence than angry that he didn't win a World Cup. It helped to reach a final in 2014. That was great. That was very good. And then I think Russia 2018, Argentina, the whole football scene was a shambles. It wasn't just Messi or the team or the squad. It was the entire industry was complete breaking point. And ultimately, I think most people were just very disappointed in football and no one was finding that escape. Again, interviewing the 1986 players, a concept they draw back to over and over is bringing joy to the people. We were just happy that we played for the people, we brought them joy, we made them happy. And I think the 1978 World Cup is particularly kind of remembered for that, because it was a, such a difficult, dark time here. And then there was this moment of joy. Mm-hmm. And I think I doubt very much, generally, Argentinians wouldn't say that Messi hasn't brought us joy. I think he absolutely has. So whether you want to win a cup for extra joy, yeah, sure, everybody loves winning. Everybody loves winning. But if it's good, if the football's good, like it was in 2014 or 2006,
yeah,
even 2010, you know, you can carry the crowd with you. There's something to enjoy, even if there's an injustice or something to complain about, or everyone can partake and say, well, you shouldn't have done him on the left, him on the back. Why did you put him on? You know, Messi needed somebody else. What was that? And that's part and parcel of the process. Everyone is a participative agent, if you like, in the discussion of what football is doing for us as a society. But ultimately, the experience of 2018 was just no joy for anybody. Nobody cared. It was horrible. It was full of rumors. It was bad. And you could really sense that. It was like, oh, well, we don't love this anymore. And there was no joy.
Yeah. Has that changed at all since 2018? Is that the sort of connection?
Well, it's difficult because 2020 has been particularly hard, hasn't it? So it's difficult to say. We'll see. We'll have to see. I think, yeah, I mean, I think it would be interesting to watch Messi over the next year and a half, see if he has another World Cup in him and what happens. And again, you know, just to close off on the point of the kind of pandemic time where there was no football and it was imaginable that everybody could die, including Maradona. We just have to see whether there is a post-pandemic time where crowds go back to the stadiums, games are played fluidly, and there is a World Cup, and maybe Messi will shine in such a scenario, or maybe he'll just grow into a quiet old man that has a lovely, restful life away from the limelight. Who knows? Anything's possible.
You mentioned in the chapter when you interviewed Messi that, you know, you'd asked him about his sort of competitiveness and, you know, whether he'd sort of, as he'd grown older, managed to sort of manage that competitive instinct. And I'm just not at all. But I'm just kind of, I wonder, like, is the sort of, because I do remember in particular from the 2018 World Cup, seeing the teams come out for the France-Argentina game, and the camera focuses on Messi's face, and he looks absolutely like that he would rather be, you know, anywhere else on earth. And I just kind of wonder whether this sort of like pressure or sort of this weight that you see him, and maybe it's just perspective that maybe you don't quite see that he feels when he's with Barcelona, whether that's purely self-imposed weight or whether that sort of comes from the outside, sort of both the legacy of Maradona and that kind of thing.
I doubt the legacy of Maradona weighs on him that much. I really think that is a media construct. I mean, I don't know, but, you know, they're so different in every way. I think, I don't know. I mean, we learned that he had these terrible nausea and vomiting, kind of almost stage fright reactions before playing international games fairly recently, well, 2014. And that was kind of, oh, does that happen to him? But again, you know, Marta Argerich is one of the best pianists in the world and in living memory, who's also an Argentinian who lives in Europe. She gets terrible stage fright to the point that she sometimes runs away and just goes, I'm not coming on. And then they have to give people their money back for the tickets. I mean, she's been doing it for 30 odd years. She just goes, I can't play, I can't play, I can't play. And just doesn't. So, you know, a great artist has that. I don't know if it's self-inflicted or somebody else's fault or whatever. Clearly Messi has it. And I've heard less about it in Barcelona than with the national team. But I suspect the pressure of playing for Argentina is much you know, much bigger, and the World Cup is a much bigger stage, and the command of the world attention is almost absolute as the tournament progresses. So if you're out early, then the group stages aren't as full of tension as a final. I mean, the final, is everyone on the planet watches it. It's extraordinary.
But this wasn't also an exclusive World Cup thing. Like, I remember the shootout against Chile when 2016 after he misses and he's off to the side, and it's absolute distraught. So it seems there is something
he retired then. He actually quit. Yes. No, I think there's a point at which he's had enough. I mean, that was interesting because he had been very outspoken about the bad organization and the mess that was the Argentine Football Association, and unusually for him, he had been critiquing the bits that aren't football quite vehemently. But I don't. I mean, is your question whether that comes from him or whether it's pressure from the people? Or I think it comes from him, but I think he's a genuinely, he's genuinely a talented guy who wants to conduct his talent in the best possible circumstances. And if the circumstances aren't right, he will say so. But obviously, it's a different personality to Maradona. So Maradona would create a massive scandal. He'd, storm into meetings. He'd coordinate a world movement of players and then fizzle into nothing. But he would be like, it's all out. But Messi's clearly quite reserved, possibly a little bit on the spectrum. He's pathologically shy. He finds it very difficult to talk. It's just different personalities. But clearly, he is superbly gifted and completely aware of that. He doesn't not know that he's the best in the world or one of the five best in the world, which is really, really important. And also willing to say his bit. And I think in a way, an interesting version of this is playing out with Barcelona now, from a few months back to now. And again, I think we should watch that space because it's quite a fascinating progression from player to something, whether he'll become involved in running the club or move to another club or what could happen.
Do you think there's a chance he'll come back to Argentina and finish his career there? Or do you think it'll be, who knows?
I would be very surprised if he did that. I think he would find that very difficult personally. But who knows? Who knows? I can imagine him more being involved in Barcelona at a different level than player than I can in Argentina. Who knows? But that's a complete guess. I wouldn't. But I do think he's got some playing time left, and I'm interested to see what he does with it. And I think he was very keen to move, and they really did thought that, in much in the way that the Hollywood studios used to do that to the big stars in the 30s. You just tie them down and say, you either work for us or don't work at all. Yeah. And that was quite difficult to witness with Messi. It just felt wrong, like from another time.
Like you say, I feel like the situation would have, the differences in sort of personality types between Messi and Maradona, how that situation last summer would have played out with a less sort of introverted character at the center of it.
Yeah, for sure.
Podcast Network.